Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Tiere has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
The KBOO Evening News. Federal prosecutors say prosecuting an Oregon spy case could reveal national secrets. Officials are already backpedaling on so-called Al-Qaeda terrorism arrests in Miami. And Costa Rica begs to leave the Bush administration's coalition of the willing. And Bush says no.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq as of today, there have been 2,515 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports 42,889 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Other experts estimate the true civilian casualty rate may be as high as 250,000 Iraqis dead.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 23, 2006. I'm Noah Eaton.
Good evening. I'm Marlise Franklin. A lawsuit challenging the National Security Agency on behalf of a defunct Islamic charity in Ashland could risk revealing state secrets, federal attorneys say. U.S. Justice Department lawyers on Wednesday delivered on their earlier promise to a judge to assert the state secrets privilege in the lawsuit filed by attorneys for the former Al-Haramain Islamic Foundation. In the suit filed last February, Al-Haramain attorneys submitted a sealed document to U.S. District Judge Gar King. They claimed it was proof the NSA illegally eavesdropped on phone conversations between one of the foundation's directors in Saudi Arabia and its U.S. attorneys. The government says the document was accidentally given to Al-Haramain attorneys and should be returned. They have filed secret explanations to King, who is left with the choice of dismissing the case or ordering the government to back up its claim about damaging national security, a step few judges have ever taken. Most lawsuits challenged under the state secrets privilege have been dismissed during the last 50 years.
Governor Kulongowski today asked a federal judge to block salvage logging from the Biscuit Fire area. The action followed Wednesday's ruling, which denied a restraining order requested by an environmental group. The governor's spokeswoman, Mary Ellen Glynn, says the Forest Service should hold off on logging in the South Calamiopsis roadless area.
We just feel like it's provocative for them to go ahead with a timber sale in a roadless area when we haven't even finished our petition right now. We were very happy with the status quo. We, under the 2001 rules put forward by the Clinton administration, roadless areas, in particular those in South Calamiopsis, were protected. And this is the first time in the entire country that the Bush administration has threatened some of our roadless areas. We see this as a very strange little sale. It's a very small sale, which can only inflame the community down there.
The governor has a hearing scheduled for August 1st on his petition to stop roadless logging in Oregon.
A proposed liquid natural gas port in Bradwood, Oregon, is gaining momentum as local groups that oppose the site are multiplying. KBOO's Jacob Fenston has more.
A coalition of homeowners in Cowlitz County, Washington, is the latest group to form in opposition to the liquid natural gas port planned in Bradwood, Oregon. The port would require dredging near the mouth of the Columbia to accommodate massive tankers delivering imported natural gas. The local homeowners are concerned about the safety risks posed by a pipeline that would carry natural gas from the Bradwood site to a main pipeline in Washington. The new pipe would run under the Columbia River and about 20 miles through Cowlitz County. Christian Bach is a member of the new coalition who says the pipeline will probably run through his neighbor's yard.
That's still close enough. If you read about pipeline explosion, you know that the zone is rather wide in case of a rupture and in case of a fire.
Northern Star Natural Gas, the company proposing the site, would use eminent domain to seize property along the pipeline. The company would compensate property owners but would not purchase the land.
I do not want to live next to a pipeline that has 1,300 PSI in it and moving 1.2 billion cubic feet of material a day through it.
That's Bill Castle, another member of the coalition. He says the pipeline would strip landowners of their rights.
We buy the land as a whole piece, and if they run a pipeline down the center of you, for example, you lose 50 feet of that, 25 feet on either side of the pipeline, for however many feet of your property they're using. And you cannot use that ground as you bought it with the intent. You can't run a road on top of it. You can't plant trees on top of it. You can't say if you want to run a water line beside it, you can't do that.
The Property Owners Coalition is one of five groups planning to file for formal intervener status. This would allow them to fight Northern Star's application to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. The commission, known as FERC, oversees the licensing process of LNG ports. One of the other groups filing for intervener status is Columbia Riverkeeper, based in Astoria.
The intervening process is a very complex process, and it's too bad that it's so complex, that the window is so short, and that you actually need a lawyer to help you become an intervener.
Cheryl Johnson of Columbia Riverkeeper.
LNG, if it gets sited on the Columbia River and in our community, will affect all of our lives. And yet the options for us to participate in this process are very narrow and very complex.
Opponents of the LNG ports say the dredging needed to accommodate the tankers would decimate habitat for salmon and other sensitive species. Here's Dan Sears with Friends of Living Oregon Waters.
You change the dynamics of the river by dredging a huge 1,000-foot turning basin. And in doing that, you know, it could change how fish are able to migrate to the area. It could also, sediments in those areas are known to be polluted. There are fish tissue samples that were taken during a study in the 90s that show really high levels of all sorts of PCBs and pesticides and heavy metals. And those things have the potential to reenter the food web if you disturb the bottom sediments.
According to Sears, LNG ports pose a security threat and could also harm commerce, such as fishing, tourism, and other commercial shipping. The proposed Bradwood site is about 30 miles upriver from Astoria. It's one of four ports proposed along the Columbia River, but it's the only site for which a formal application has been submitted. Currently, there are only four LNG ports operating in the country. For KBOO News, I'm Jacob Fenston.
The Legislative Emergency Board has granted $2.7 million in extra funding to process a surge of property compensation claims under Measure 37. The additional money will enable the state to hire 18 full-time staff to process claims and meet a Measure 37 requirement to resolve claims within 6 months. If the state doesn't act in 6 months, property owners can go to court to get their claims upheld, plus attorney fees and other expenses. Property owners have filed nearly 1,900 claims with the state, and officials expect 150 new claims per month before a December deadline. That's more than double the claims expected when the state budget was approved last year.
A lawsuit filed this year in New York federal court against the FDA seeks to clarify why the morning after pill wasn't approved for sale over the counter. Rebecca Miles files this report from the Big Apple, where New York University students organized a discussion with the suit's plaintiffs about the fight for women's reproductive rights.
At New York University last night, plaintiffs in the lawsuit discussed the history of access to controlling women's reproduction in the United States. Carol Giardina, chair of the Red Stockings Allies and Veterans, said a strategist in the group had warned members not to settle for the partial win in abortion rights, as the seeds of backlash were planted in the growing compromise. Giardina said the lesson to learn is to maintain an offensive position.
For example, moving proactively for the morning after pill sooner might have been more effective than the defensive posture, "We won't go back." If we already know that they're going to try to take back what we won, from the get-go, we should ask ourselves, what are we going to do about that? To answer that question, the movement should ask more questions like, who are they anyway? Who benefits? What do they want to do that women having control over reproduction will stop them from being able to do? Think about it. Half the pregnancies in the U.S. each year are unplanned.
Simon Heller is an attorney with the Center for Reproductive Rights and lead counsel in the lawsuit Tumino versus von Essenbach, the current head of the FDA. He sees the lawsuit as a means to restoring scientific integrity to the FDA, and added that in part of the discovery process in the lawsuit, they requested documents the government didn't initially want them to have.
Documents showing that the White House was kept informed about the Plan B process. Documents showing that Commissioner McClellan decided against approval of Plan B even before a review of the scientific evidence was complete.
If Tumino and the Center for Reproductive Rights win the lawsuit, the damages sought would require the morning after pill to be made available immediately for over-the-counter sale. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting from New York.
A Fort Bragg paratrooper's death may have been caused by vaccinations he received for smallpox and influenza, the Pentagon said. Private First Class Christopher Justin Abston of Smiths Grove, Kentucky, died unexpectedly in his barracks in December, 16 days after receiving the vaccines. Officials said the smallpox vaccine the soldier received is known to cause an inflammation of the heart muscle, or myocarditis, a condition found at his autopsy. The United States ended routine childhood vaccination against smallpox in 1971, and the World Health Organization reported the disease was eradicated in 1980. But about 15 months after the September 11th attacks, the U.S. government ordered certain military personnel vaccinated and recommended shots for frontline healthcare workers.
Two senators, including top Democrat on the Armed Services Committee, are pressing the Pentagon for answers in the case of two California National Guard members murdered by Iraqi civil defense officers they were training. Senators Barbara Boxer and Carl Levine say they'll seek answers that the two soldier survivors have not been able to obtain, even in personal briefings the families have received yesterday from an Army general. Army Specialist Patrick R. McCaffrey and 2nd Lieutenant Andre D. Tyson died in an ambush 2 years ago. It was not until this week that the military acknowledged that the two were killed by members of the Iraqi Civil Defense Corps they were training and patrolling with.
Seven men accused of trying to blow up the Sears Tower with help from Al-Qaeda never actually made contact with the terrorist network and were instead caught in an FBI sting involving an informant who posed as an Al-Qaeda operative, authorities said today. Federal prosecutors said the men, who operated out of a warehouse in Miami's blighted Liberty City section, took an oath to Al-Qaeda and plotted to create an Islamic army bent on violence against the United States. Five of those arrested are U.S. citizens. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez stressed that there was no immediate threat in either Chicago or Miami because the group did not have explosives or other materials it was seeking. Nevertheless, Gonzalez said Thursday's arrest underscored the danger of, quote, homegrown terrorists, unquote, who, quote, view their home country as the enemy, unquote.
The Bush administration said today an anti-terrorism program that taps into an immense international database of confidential financial records has adequate safeguards to protect Americans' privacy. Democrats and civil liberties groups said the effort had disturbing similarities to another controversial anti-terrorism program of warrantless spying on telephone calls and emails. The program, kept secret until it was revealed yesterday by news organizations, has been going on since shortly after the September 11, 2001 terror attacks. Using broad government subpoenas, the program allows U.S. counterterrorism analysts to route about 11 million financial transactions daily among 7,800 banks and other financial institutions in 200 countries. Treasury Secretary John Snow called the financial records effort government at its best and said, quote, entirely consistent with our democratic values, with our best legal traditions, end quote.
Personal data, including the social security numbers of 28,000 sailors and members of their families, have been found on a civilian website, triggering a criminal investigation. The Navy said today the information was in five documents and included people's names, birth dates, and social security numbers. Navy spokesman Lieutenant Justin Cole would not identify the website or its owner, but said the information had been removed. He would not provide any details about how the information ended up on the site.
Former Vice President Walter Mondale supports a preemptive U.S. strike against a North Korean missile, saying the U.S. should tell North Korea to dismantle the missile or, quote, we are going to take it out, end quote. He also says, I think it would end the nuclear long-range dreams of this dangerous country, end quote. Mondale, who was the 1984 Democratic presidential nominee and a former U.S. ambassador to Japan, the tensions are over North Korea's apparent preparations to test fire a Taepodong 2 missile, which is believed to have a range of up to 9,300 miles. That would make it capable of hitting much of the U.S. mainland.
Refugees stranded at the Jordanian border with Iraq have begun an indefinite hunger strike to demand a solution to their predicament. Ula Farawadi reports from Amman.
Some 200 Iranian Kurdish refugees who have been stranded on the Jordanian-Iraq border since January 2005 began a hunger strike on Tuesday demanding resettlement in a third country. The hunger strike comes after several unsuccessful pleas for resettlement to the world community. The Iranian Kurdish refugees arrived at the Kurama border crossing between Jordan and Iraq 18 months ago after fleeing Al-Tash refugee camp in Iraq's western Anbar province following clashes there between insurgents and U.S. forces. But since they lack official permission to enter Jordan, the refugees have remained on the Iraqi side of the border in an area prone to harsh weather conditions. However, the United Nations High Commission for Refugees has said that there is no pressing need for the refugees to leave the country and that they should go back to their homes in northern Iraq, something the refugees refuse to do. In Amman, Jordan, this is Ola Farawati reporting for Free Speech, Radio News.
The United States has turned down a request by Costa Rica to remove its name from all documents that list it as supporting the Iraq invasion. The Central American nation initially backed the invasion, but opinion polls now show most Costa Ricans are against it. Following a Supreme Court ruling in 2004, the U.S. removed Costa Rica's name from one list named the Coalition of the Willing. However, Costa Rica still appears in archived documents and related websites. The U.S. says they cannot be modified as they form part of the historic record.
The current time is 5:17. And now time for another Half-Loon Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
We know that politics can make strange bedfellows, but who would have thought it would get as strange as Senator Rick Santorum? At issue is the location of Rick's bed. That is, where does he live? You would naturally assume that this Republican senator from Pennsylvania lives somewhere in the Keystone State. And indeed, Santorum lists a house in the burg of Penn Hills as his home. However, when the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette sent a routine letter to the senator's home address, it came back marked by the post office as not deliverable as addressed. Why? Simple. Rick doesn't actually live there. The house is vacant. No bed, no kitchen table, no curtains, no Santorums. Instead, Rick, his wife, and their six kiddos are ensconced in the family's real home in faraway Leesburg, Virginia. Perhaps he sometimes visits Penn Hills, but the fact is that Santorum does not sleep, eat, raise kids, or otherwise live in the house or town he officially claims as his home. Nor, for that matter, does the senator from Pennsylvania even live in the state he claims to represent. Bizarrely, when this embarrassing reality surfaced, Rick responded not with an explanation, but an accusation. He nastily attacked his Democratic opponent in this year's senatorial race, charging that the Democrat had sent operatives to trespass on the family's property. This charge turns out not to be true, but nonetheless, Santorum wailed that such trespassing, quote, put our six young children at a serious safety risk. Wow, Rick has completely redefined political absurdity. First, there was no trespassing by the Democrats' campaign, and second, the senator's kids could only have been at risk if they actually were there, which they weren't, since, of course, they live in Virginia, as does Mom and Dad. This is Jim Hightower saying, Santorum is so strange that he's not even bedfellows with the people of his state. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Yes. Stay tuned for Counterspin and independent Native news following our newscast at 6 o'clock. Listen in to the Bread and Roses show. At 7, it's Essence of Soul. Weather, heat wave, according to record highs throughout the Willamette Valley and Columbia Gorge throughout the weekend, reaching the mid to upper 90s. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
The United Nations Development Project is asking village chiefs in rural India to fight human trafficking by keeping a register of people who live in search of work. The UNDP is to work with 15,000 village councils in 11 states over the next 10 months. The UNDP says it also wants to start building links between villages and trafficking destinations such as red light districts or large cities.
The Indian government is to hold direct peace talks with the largest separatist group in Assam state, the United Liberation Front of Assam, or ULFA. ULFA has been fighting for independent state for more than 25 years. Thousands have been killed on both sides of the conflict. The government will also consider the rebels' demand for the release of five ULFA leaders.
The Israeli government announced that it is planning a campaign to stop international peace activists from entering the country this summer. They deported 9 Italian peace workers today from Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv. This new Israeli policy comes in the midst of an Israeli escalation in violence that has resulted in 22 Palestinians killed in the last week and 79 injured by Israeli airstrikes. Saeed Benora reports from the Palestinian territories.
In response to this week's escalation in violence by Israeli forces, Palestinian civil society has called for nonviolent protests in Palestine in a bid to prove to the world that they remain committed to peaceful negotiation. Abdullah Abu Rahma, with the Popular Committee Against the Wall, has organized weekly nonviolent anti-wall protests in his village for the last year.
This will definitely affect our struggle. There have been several internationals who have been expelled out of Palestine and were barred from coming back. The plan of the Israeli intelligence services is to bar those activists from entering Palestine in solidarity with the people here, because the internationals are our real ambassadors to their countries. They see the reality on the ground. They show people the reality of the suffering of the Palestinians, and they witness the abuse practiced against unarmed Palestinians. That's why the army fears them and their increasing number, because they witness the nature of the suffering of the Palestinian people.
The new Israeli policy affects a number of international peace groups, including the International Solidarity Movement, which planned a Freedom Summer campaign to nonviolently protest the Israeli wall, expansion, and violence. Netta Golan is an Israeli activist and one of the founders of the International Solidarity Movement.
We know that when Palestinians resist nonviolently alone, they're shot at with live ammunition and killed. We also know from soldiers who have testified in court that when internationals and Israelis are present, they have different orders for opening fire. And if Israelis and internationals are not present, they use what they usually use for Palestinians, and that's live ammunition.
According to Alex Fishman, the senior security analyst of Israeli newspaper Yadot Ahronot, 300 artillery shells a day are being fired by Israeli forces into the Gaza Strip, one of the most densely populated places on earth. The Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert expressed regret that civilians had been killed, but stated that the offensive would continue, while the Israeli Minister of Security Omer Peretz stated that the Israeli offensive in the Gaza Strip is just beginning, and no Palestinian will be immune to the Israeli attacks. This is Saeed Banoura reporting from imemc.org for Free Speech Radio News in Beit Sahour, Palestine.
Environmental agencies say Chechnya, devastated by 11 years of war, now faces ecological disaster. Unregulated development and conflict between separatists and the Russian army has left rivers badly affected by leaking oil pipelines and damaged sewers. The World Wildlife Fund has reported that illegal logging is destroying dense mountain forests. Chemical and radioactive pollution from bombed-out chemical laboratories are also causing concern.
Doctors in the Bolivian capital La Paz have staged a protest against Cuban medics offering free health care to the poor. But doctors say the Cubans are taking jobs away from unemployed Bolivian doctors. They want the Bolivian government to subsidize the national medical service so it is free at the point of delivery. More than 1,000 doctors are reported to have been dispatched by Fidel Castro's government to provide health services in Bolivia, along with several thousand in Venezuela.
Teenage girls in Cameroon have launched a nationwide campaign against the practice of so-called breast ironing. The group called itself the Association of Aunties. It wants to stop adolescent girls undergoing painful practices in order to reduce the size of their breasts. The practice, which around a quarter of all girls undergo at puberty, involves pounding or massaging the developing breasts with hot objects. Many people believe it protects young women from the sexual advances of boys and men.
Cebu Evening News for Friday, June 23, 2006. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264 AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220 HR. You can log on to our website at kbu.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Josonia Watson. Our assistant producer is Ross Egan. Our AP Wire editors are Ross Egan and Noah Eaton. Myself, hey, that rhymes pretty closely. Tonight's audio editor is Josonia Watson. Special thanks to reporter Jacob Fenston. Our engineer is Brian Averill. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Noah Eaton, telling you to keep that banana boat on this hot weekend and make sure that you keep well under shade.
Thanks, Noah. I'm Marlise Franklin. Stay tuned for Counterspin and Independent Native News. And then on Monday morning, bright and early at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, it's More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. 9 o'clock a.m. brings the Old Mole Variety Hour, which features progressive news and interviews. At 10 o'clock a.m., Dr. David Naiman hosts Health Watch. And at 10:30 Monday, The Environment features Scott Forrester. At 11, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. That's all right here on KBOO. This is your community, nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored radio station. Thanks a lot for joining us, and have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the title of the book says it all, Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush. Author Eric Bollert will join us to talk about how and why the Beltway Press Corps has done its part to prop up the Bush presidency. And with Bush down in the polls, has the media mood changed at all? Also on the show, there's no drug worse than meth, claimed U.S. drug czar John Walters in a recent AP story, though the story itself was about how seizures of methamphetamine laboratories are way down. If you're confused by the media's meth storyline, there's good reason for that. A new report says media trumpeting of a national meth epidemic is simply way off base. We'll hear from the report's author, Ryan King, of the Sentencing Project. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
A June 12th op-ed in the New York Times made a bold accusation. Anti-war activists have targeted the funerals of Iraq war soldiers with noisy protests. But evidence to back up that charge is non-existent. The author of the piece, writer Karen Spears Zacharias, recounted an interview with a war widow who said that anti-war protesters lined the streets across from the service, carried signs, and, quote, shouted as her husband's flag-draped coffin was carried past. Close quote. Zacharias took the point even further, referring to, quote, hundreds of anti-war protesters who appear at military hospitals and funerals. Close quote. But to many readers, that did sound like anti-war activism. What it did sound like was the work of homophobic hate monger Fred Phelps, who has been celebrating military deaths to protest the military's don't ask, don't tell policy. When questioned by Fair, the Times said it was looking into the story. On June 17th, that's one day after Fair sent out an action alert on the matter, the Times issued an op-ed page correction, acknowledging that the writer was not able to offer evidence to back up her claims. That's all well and good, but Fair's original point remains. Even though this was an opinion piece, the baseless anecdotes about funeral protests were the whole premise of the column. And, much like the unsubstantiated claims of Vietnam-era protesters spitting on returning soldiers, they served to smear an entire political movement. The Times should have shown more interest in getting the facts right beforehand.
Conservative media critics complain about a lot of things. Most recently, though, they seem fixated on one thing. The Iraq war isn't going as badly as reporters would have you believe. A recent version of this line was heard on CNN's Reliable Sources on June 18th when John Fund of the Wall Street Journal editorial page claimed that some supposed good news from Iraq was being actively suppressed. In the wake of the killing of al-Qaeda leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, computer files that some allege belonged to al-Qaeda were discovered, and according to these documents, the insurgents in Iraq were worried about losing the war. As Fund put it, quote, "We have found computer files in Zarqawi's computer, which shows he was very pessimistic about the insurgency and said time was on the American side. That got very little coverage, even though my intelligence sources say it's been completely authenticated," close quote. Now, we understand that in the world of cable news, there's always a slot reserved for conservative pundits to say whatever's on their mind. But surely a self-respecting host would have stepped in at that point to point out that, first of all, the story of the seized files got major national news treatment, including, if not especially, on CNN itself, where news shows led with it on June 15th. If the coverage didn't suit Fund's taste, that might be because, unlike his sources, the sources that every other outlet was talking to said, as AP put it on June 16th, quote, "There was no way to confirm the authenticity of the information attributed to al-Qaeda, and U.S. and Iraqi officials offered conflicting accounts of when and where it was seized," close quote. Now, John Fund may have his own special standards of evidence, but what's CNN's excuse?
On June 17th, the New York Times published a revealing front-page story on Haditha, the Iraqi town where U.S. Marines killed 24 civilians last November after a roadside bomb killed a Marine and injured two others. Initially, the Marines at the scene claimed the dead civilians were simply collateral damage, but a Time magazine expose in March and leaked details of a U.S. military investigation suggested the civilians were murdered. Things have been looking bad for the Marines, with rumors that some might face murder charges. But the New York Times report seemed to suggest that the story was becoming more complicated, that perhaps the evidence wasn't so clear. First, in the headline, "Contradictions Cloud Inquiry into 24 Iraqi Deaths." And then, again, in the story's lead, which called the forensic evidence ambiguous. But the Times report itself contained very little in the way of ambiguity. Virtually all of the military investigators and forensic evidence cited indicated a massacre by the Marines. For instance, investigators found that most of the victims were shot through the brain or heart, and that five men traveling in a car had been executed, not shot while fleeing, as the Marines had initially insisted. Was the Times trying to impose a warped notion of even-handedness on a story whose facts were decidedly one-sided? Was this an attempt to escape the wrath of right-wing critics? We don't know, but we do know that when a story's headline and lead undercut the actual reporting, many readers will be misled.
As of late, media watchers have noticed two trends in Beltway reporting: Bush's supposed bounce in the polls and the notion that behind the scenes things are a-changin' at the White House. The credit for the latter usually goes to new White House Chief of Staff Josh Bolton. To hear the media tell it, he's got the White House running on all cylinders. Staffers are fully engaged and the Bush administration has some momentum. And who's telling the media this? Well, White House officials and assorted other Republicans. Such was the case with a June 19th story in the New York Times under the headline, "An Eye for Detail and the Resolve to Push Change." Weighing in on the White House's streak of good fortune, former Iraq spokesman Dan Senor, Bolton himself, former Reagan aide Ken Duberstein, and Republican Senator Trent Lott. The only voice of moderation was another Republican, Arlen Specter, who could only say it was too early to tell how effective Bolton's been. The kicker came from one Republican close to the White House who offered that Bolton has enormous influence and that there is, quote, more openness. There is more real discussion about the challenges that are faced, close quote. That assessment of a new openness came from a source who asks not to be named.
And finally, we told you a few weeks back about an edition of NBC's Meet the Press that featured discussion of rising gas prices, but included only government officials, representatives of oil and energy industries, and, well, CNBC's Jim Cramer. No consumer advocate, no environmental advocate, no advocate of alternative energy. Despite that one-sidedness, host Tim Russert ended that April 30th show by apologizing for not including even more industry voices, saying, quote, our viewers should know we did invite the representatives of the major oil companies, Shell, Chevron, BP, ExxonMobil, Sunoco, and ConocoPhillips to be with us today. They declined. We hope they will join us in the future, close quote. Well, that dream came true on June 18th when Russert hosted a discussion of gas prices featuring only Shell Oil President John Hofmeister, ConocoPhillips Chair James Mulva, and Chevron CEO David O'Reilly. Quote, how can the chief executives of the big oil companies explain the skyrocketing prices at the pump? Close quote, asked Russert at the top of the show before allowing those executives to do just that. A wonderful PR opportunity for the industry, no doubt, but surely NBC knows that that's just one side of the story, and hardly a disinterested one. Meanwhile, we have yet to see the Meet the Press on which environmental and consumer representatives get to challenge and to counter the industry view. And needless to say, there have been no apologies for that.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair.
Last week here on Counterspin, we talked about a review of a new book called Lapdogs. The reviewer, former Washington Post ombudsman Michael Gettler, thought it was a bit unfair to characterize the press corps as being in the tank for George W. Bush. The actual evidence might support that conclusion, but surely reporters don't think that's what they're doing, so it's unfair to judge them by the content of their work. Well, perhaps that's the only way to dismiss this book. The evidence compiled in it is pretty overwhelming. Joining us now to talk about it is the author of the book, Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush. Eric Bollert joins us now. Welcome back to Counterspin, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
Now, anyone not persuaded by the case you make in Lapdogs might look at the media coverage of the past week or so and admit you have a point. There's been a media trend that might be called the Bush bounce. You've written about it. Tell us what we're seeing.
Well, it was interesting. I mean, particularly when Zarqawi was captured and murdered, and then Karl Rove was informed he was not going to be indicted, and there were a couple other minor events. We've seen this pattern again and again. The White House immediately announces, you know, that some sort of corner has been turned or that things are suddenly on the right track. And the press just absolutely just laps it up. I mean, it just repeats it ad nauseum.
We see like a one-point increase in a poll, and suddenly that's...
Right, so... So it's interesting, even before any polls were done, if you turned on the cable channels and even the weekend talk shows and even in the print, I think it was unprecedented. It was not that Bush had had a bounce, it was Bush was going to get a bounce. You know, the press was sort of previewing this bounce that had yet to come, but everyone knew it was going to come because, my gosh, look at all the good news coming out of Iraq. So then, you know, three of the last four national polls actually indicate there was no bounce whatsoever. The other thing that I noted that was interesting in all this Bush bounce talk is there was very little context about where Bush was in the polls. I mean, most of the coverage, you know, acknowledged that he had had, you know, a rocky second term and that the war has taken its toll on the polls. But they absolutely refused to point out that George W. Bush is an historically unpopular president. I mean, he's only Richard Nixon has been able in modern times to string as many months in sub-40 job approval polling ratings the way Bush has. And, if, you know, to get a bounce, as I wrote, you know, he'd need a hydraulic lift to get back to respectability.
You know, in the last chapter of your book, Lapdogs, there was sort of a Bush bounce preview earlier this year in January, where the press seemed again primed for this idea that Bush was going to turn the corner because the calendar said that 2005 was over. There's an interesting point you made early in the book. The conventional wisdom says the soft coverage of Bush can be traced back to the trauma of the 9/11 attacks. You think that there's a period that came 3 years later that might stand as an even better example of how the media treated Bush. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, actually, I opened the book. The first chapter deals with the one-year period. September 2nd, 2004, Bush accepts the nomination in Madison Square Garden for the second term. September 2nd, 2005, 1 year later, he's telling Michael Brown down in the Gulf Coast that he's doing a heck of a job with the Katrina relief. So I use those as two bookends to look at Bush's coverage for those 12 months in between. I argue in that chapter that Bush probably got some of his softest, most revered coverage, mainstream media coverage, in that period. I argue that 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq and the sort of the patriotic fervor those events whipped up, those don't explain what happened with the press and Bush during his term. They're crucial elements. But the fact that he got his most kind coverage 4 years after 9/11 and 2 years after the invasion of Iraq, I think that indicates there's something wider in play.
Now, Mark Hertzgard, of course, wrote a famous book about media coverage of the Reagan administration. Your book can be seen almost as an update of that in some key ways. If someone finds the book persuasive, of course, the logical question has to be why. What is it about the press that causes them to treat Bush or Reagan differently? Obviously, they're both Republicans, but there's got to be more to it than that.
Yeah, both Republicans, both for big chunks of their two terms, enjoyed very high approval rating. But I think the big issue at play is this right-wing attack on the press that's been going on for almost 35 years. It's produced extraordinary benefits for conservatives, and it's really put the press back on their heels. They've developed these rabbit ears about this liberal bias charge, and they embrace and are overly sensitive to this charge, while at the same time they're easily dismissed media criticism from the left. And during the 90s, during the Clinton years, how do you prove that you don't have liberal bias? Well, you go after the Clintons and you launch these fantastic pursuits like Whitewater and selling nuclear secrets to China in exchange for campaign contributions, all these sort of rabbit hole excursions that went nowhere. And during the Bush years, how do you prove that you're not liberal? You talk about how resolute Bush is and now about he doesn't care about polls and he's authentic and things like that. So I think that helps explain sort of this titanic shift we saw the press in its coverage of this Republican administration and the previous Democratic one.
Tim Russert, you quoted him speaking about the Swift boats. People will remember them from the 2004 campaign. And he posed this question, why is this resonating so much? As if he had nothing to do with keeping a story like that alive.
Right. The press absolutely refuses to acknowledge the role that it plays in all of these things. And that was a perfect example. I mean, this was at the end of August 2004 when the Beltway press had spent almost the entire month churning through the Swift boat, what I call Swift boat hoax or dirty trick, which essentially is what it was. I mean, none of these guys who stepped forward 35 years after the fact had any documents to prove their case against Kerry. Some of them had clearly and publicly flip-flopped on Kerry. And yet the press just sort of threw up its hands and said, gosh, you know, we can't figure out, you know, fog of war. We don't know what John Kerry, we'll never know what John Kerry, you know, did in Vietnam. Well, you know, the U.S. Navy knows what John Kerry did in Vietnam because there's records like everyone else who served. Mm-hmm. And all the records back up his cause. But here was Russert in sort of his roundtable at the end of August talking with Jay Kearney from Time. And he says, you know, he finally, after a month, he gets around to asking the relevant question that everyone ignored for a month. He asked Kearney, were the charges accurate? And Kearney from Time Magazine basically in this very mealy-mouthed way says no. Not that anyone at Time Magazine had printed that in the previous month. And you're right, then Russert sort of throws up his hands and says, why is it resonating? Well, it's resonating, as I pour down the book, because between ABC, CBS, and NBC, the nightly news, just the nightly news, They did something like 24 stories in the month of August on the Swift boat veteran.
August is often known as a month where nothing happens in the media, so
right.
I suppose that was it. Well, we know the press corps finally always love a storyline. Is there a chance that Bush's low standing in the polls and his sort of lame duck status will eventually cause some kind of pile-on effect where the media will finally decide, you know, the public has been right all along.
No.
This guy is not very popular.
There's no way. I mean, you know, I finished this book in March. And it's been out since May, and I have more than enough for another chapter. I mean, I'm absolutely convinced that summer of 2008, we're going to be seeing the same dynamics, the same narrative, and I guarantee we're going to be seeing the exact same reports about Iraq, for instance. The press is in a time warp, and it's just replaying the same show over and over.
We'll be looking forward to the Bush Bounce 08 story. We've been speaking with Eric Bollert. You can read him regularly at the Huffington Post website, and his book, Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, is out now from Free Press. Eric Bollert, thanks again for joining us on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
You've probably seen at least one story presenting methamphetamine as the new scourge of the nation, a peculiarly addictive drug whose escalating use and devastating impact are leading to cries of epidemic. A new report from the Sentencing Project, however, says that while such stories might make good copy, they don't reflect good journalism. The Sentencing Project does research and advocacy on criminal justice policy. While any drug that causes problems is a problem, the report says there's just no foundation to the meth epidemic story as the media are telling it, either in its broad strokes or in many of its particulars. Ryan King is policy analyst at the Sentencing Project and author of the new report, The Next Big Thing, Methamphetamine in the United States, which has already been attacked by Bill O'Reilly. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Ryan King.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, what is the meth story that media are telling, and where does it diverge from what your research indicates is the reality?
Well, the media story on methamphetamine has sort of been two-pronged. One is that it is an epidemic, that it is spreading across the country. Certain communities, it has already taken hold and is really ripping through and destroying families and neighborhoods. And in other communities, it's going to be coming soon. So we see two types of reports in areas where methamphetamine has already emerged. We see that the aftermath report, and in places like the Northeast where there haven't been, we see reports about that it's coming, we need to be prepared. And the result is we've seen some state legislators begin to entertain passing more punitive sentencing laws in advance in anticipation of this inevitable methamphetamine epidemic. And the second prong has primarily been that methamphetamine is untreatable. Its effects are irreversible, and that basically once an individual starts using it, they're hooked almost instantly, and their lives are generally spiral out of control. In both of these cases, there are communities that are indeed impacted by methamphetamine, and its consequences of its use are quite dangerous. But in both cases, the media has really grossly overstated those figures.
Well, these are major media, let's be clear, that you're talking about, places like Newsweek.
Oh, no, it's everything from major publications such as Newsweek, New York Times, down to local newspapers, and literally everything in between. And it's been relatively consistent. The message is very, very similar. I mean, an August 2005 piece was titled America's Most Dangerous Drug. That was the cover story of Newsweek, and it was referred to as an epidemic and a plague that's, quote, quietly marching across the country and up the socioeconomic ladder. The only thing that was missing from that article was any empirical substantiation of those claims.
Well, in looking at the coverage, and a good chunk of the report does examine carefully this media coverage, one of the problems that you found was just that this sort of story, the way it's framed, it doesn't even seem to call for a dissenting or a critical point of view.
I think what's happened is it has become kind of a given for a journalist. The methamphetamine epidemic. I mean, you almost never see the word methamphetamine unless it's trailed by the word epidemic. So there's no longer a need to establish that there is an epidemic. So if you go and you ask somebody for a quote, you're just going to take that as a given that they are indeed accurately representing reality. And the danger is that these stories are all like each one is like the other. And so we'll have it leads off with an anecdote, and then it follows with a quote from an official. And in most cases, there's really no data that's substantiating any of these. But instead, the anecdote and the one or two quotes stand for the validation that there is indeed a methamphetamine epidemic.
And some of those quotes, it's interesting, you say that they're often using officials who are speaking really outside their area of expertise.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the real dangers we see. The Newsweek story, there's a quote in there saying, you know, like the addiction itself, this epidemic of methamphetamine can only be arrested and not cured. And the source of this quote was not a law enforcement expert, nor was it a treatment professional, but it was the opinion of a 46-year-old former methamphetamine dealer. We'll also see, you know, quotes from law enforcement saying that, I have one in here, meth makes crack look like child's play, both in terms of what it does to the body and how hard it is to get off. If you're talking about the impact on law enforcement, you should talk to a law enforcement official. But to have a law enforcement official speculating about its receptivity to treatment or its impact on the body is completely inappropriate.
Well, what do you say to someone who says, okay, media are exaggerating the problem, but what's really the downside of that? They're calling attention to something that's a problem. What is the potential harm of this kind of coverage?
Well, there's a few there. I think the first harm is that we've actually seen studies of a lot of the anti-drug abuse advertising in the last two decades, and most of that is frequently exaggerated consequences of drug use. And we've actually seen studies that suggest that people who view those advertisements afterwards have less negative attitudes about those drugs. And there's speculation that it's either that they've become desensitized or that these advertisements actually sort of pique people's interest in a substance. So that's one danger. And a second one, I think, and one of the really big ones, is that if the media is perpetuating this story that methamphetamine doesn't respond to treatment, when in fact, consistently across all of the treatment literature, it's shown that it does respond to treatment, certainly not 100%, but at least equal relative to other drugs. Mm-hmm. If that message is that it doesn't respond to treatment, then why would the federal or state government want to invest resources into treatment? That's the real danger for the communities where methamphetamine is a serious problem. They need resources, and we hear from county officials who are saying, you know, we are overrun with methamphetamine addiction in this county. Well, if the message is that treatment doesn't work, well, then you're not going to get those resources, and instead the response is going to be throw more people in prison and throw away the key.
Talk briefly about that Montana meth project. That was a public education campaign that was very popular, might even be a model for other states. What's interesting to you there?
It's absolutely becoming a model for other states. And essentially, the Montana meth project was sort of learning from the last 20 years or so of anti-drug abuse advertising and really kicking it up to a whole new level. And that is extremely graphic, intense advertisements. And the general message of these advertisements, I think their tagline is meth not even once. And the general message is that using it even once is going to have these very dire consequences. So they're trying to really use very graphic and grisly scare tactics to deter people from ever trying methamphetamine, which is obviously certainly a noble goal to keep people from using it. But the problem is that this program, because it's new and because it was funded by a businessman almost entirely, it's received a lot of media attention, and the media nationally has conflated broad attention with success. And in reality, there have not been any sort of wide-scale, independent, and empirical evaluation of this program. But instead, we see people walking around saying, well, all I know is it works.
So there's that media solipsism where media are covering it, therefore it is a success. Facts, you know, be damned. Well, let me ask you finally, Fox's Bill O'Reilly, as I mentioned at the top, tried to attack your report on June 21st, but his guest, Mark Kleiman of UCLA, didn't really do that, and in fact said at one point, we don't have any official data sources that could refute this study. I wonder what, if anything, you made of that, and really what has the media reception been to a report that is, among other things, a criticism of the media?
Well, we've actually had a couple of phone calls from some individuals and newspapers that have been very supportive. They're interested in the report, and they want to sort of compare it to what the coverage has been in their jurisdictions. So that's positive, and we're really hoping that was one of the goals, is to raise awareness and at the very least make reporters more critical in the evaluation of the quotes and information that they're given from certain officials. But unfortunately, by and large, the most common result has been just an absolute misrepresentation of what the report is about. So that ranges anything from lead lines of reports saying the Sentencing Project issues reports saying that methamphetamine isn't as addictive as has been believed, which is not at all. There's no mention, and in fact, the first paragraph of our report is dedicated to staking out the very clear position that methamphetamine is very dangerous. And then we've seen other ones. The real irony of our report, of course, is that anecdotes and quotes are used in the absence of data to have substantiated this methamphetamine epidemic. And then we see a report in one local news source that shows our findings and then has a quote from a law enforcement official countering those findings and saying that, well, the fact is that methamphetamine is the number two most used drug in the United States. Well, in fact, that is not the fact, and it's not even close to the number two used drug. But in a bias of balance, we see that the quote of a law enforcement official is used as an equal weight to our report, which is chock full of official key government indicators on drug use. And so anybody who would read that would walk away thinking, you know, well, maybe it's a sentencing project or maybe it's this one law enforcement official. And frankly, the opinions are not equal in their validity.
We've been speaking with policy analyst Ryan King of the Sentencing Project. You can read their report for yourself. It's called The Next Big Thing, Methamphetamine in the United States. You'll find it on their website, sentencingproject.org. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group Fair, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on Fair's website, www.fair.org. That's also the place to sign up for Fair's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin. This is Independent Native News for Friday, the 23rd of June. I'm Bonnie C. Hitchcock. A nationwide effort is about to get underway to purge Medicaid rolls of non-U.S. citizens. Starting next month, Medicaid recipients must provide proof of citizenship with a birth certificate or passport. Congress passed the new rule, but the job of verifying citizenship falls to the states. Michael Marchand is a Medicaid spokesman in Seattle.
If it's the case on the rare circumstance when a state is unable to secure any evidence whatsoever of citizenship, there is the potential for that person to get a written affidavit, which would be attesting that this person is a citizen and establishes the applicant's or the recipient's claim to citizenship.
Nonetheless, the governors of Washington and Oregon say they're concerned. In Washington, there are nearly 800,000 Medicaid recipients. Governor Chris Gregoire is worried the requirement will be an undue burden on the elderly, children, and Native Americans, many of whom do not have birth certificates if they have lived all their lives on reservations. Gregoire estimates it will cost $5 million to do the purge. In other news, a California group is taking a stand against reservation shopping and urging the passage of laws to make it illegal. Ellen Cherchak reports from Sacramento.
The California Tribal Business Alliance, which consists of six tribes, including two tribes near the state's capital, has come out against reservation shopping. Executive Director Allison Harvey says members fear when tribes try to build casinos in urban areas off their reservations, it angers citizens who could decide to repeal the measures which made Indian gambling legal in California in the first place.
It's a potential threat to the public's long-term goodwill towards tribal gaming.
Harvey says about two dozen California tribes now have applications before the federal government to build casinos off their reservations. I'm Ellen Cherchak in Sacramento.
About 600 Air National Guard soldiers from remote Alaska villages are preparing to deploy to Iraq after first training for 3 months in Camp Shelby, Mississippi. Village economies rely heavily on subsistence hunting and fishing, and losing so many men during the summer season will take a toll on families in the region. But as Angela Denning Barnes reports, communities like Kuitluk in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta region are trying to prepare and supporting the men with potlatches and community festivals.
Specialist David Nanning of Bethel went to the ceremony in Kuitluk. He is one of about 150 young men from the YK Delta who are deploying on July 8th.
I've been spending time with my family as much as I can, you know, helping them out and visiting relatives in the villages. You know, we're going to be gone for a long time.
Nanning, who's 24, says that deploying to Iraq is his duty as a National Guardsman.
It kind of saddens me, but at the same time, you know, that's what the Army's all about. You know, I didn't think we'd get deployed because, you know, Bethel never got deployed for a long time, which is part of the reason why I enlisted. You know, I didn't think we were going to get deployed, but...
19-year-old Daniel Aguchek of Scammon Bay also attended the ceremony in Queefook. He says he has prepared for his departure in a couple of ways.
I've been talking with my family, trying to get my family mindset and spiritually ready, and I'm just getting ready.
Aguchek says the ceremony and community festivals make leaving a little easier, but he says there are some things he knows he will miss.
My family, going out hunting, everything, subsistence and everything. Oh, I feel sad and I'm very worried and I'm scared, but I can deal with it if I get totally mindset and everything.
This deployment marks the first time since World War II that guardsmen from Western Alaska have been called to war. Until their deployment July 8th, festivals for the soldiers will continue in the YK Delta with church services, potlatches, and fiddling. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by News from Indian Country's e-edition, online at IndianCountryNews.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Up next, Bread and Roses.